I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Susan Pinker joins me now, the noted psychologist and author, has a new book out, The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier and Happier. It's an engaging book on how the human need for contact from other humans is vitally important nowadays, especially in the internet age. The book provides a lot of fascinating research, such as social neuroscience, as well as anecdotes and examples of how social bonds can improve our well-being, physical and otherwise. I'll get Ms. Pinker, who joins me from Montreal this day, to tell us about what she's found out in the course of writing this book, what she's found profound in her own experience, as well as how we might improve our own lives. Susan Pinker is a Canadian developmental psychologist and author and broadcaster. Her previous book, The Sexual Paradox, was a bestseller and a critical success. SusanPinker.com is the website for more. This new book is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Susan Pinker. Ms. Pinker, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. I'm very curious to know about the genesis of a book like this, because was this something that you lived with for a long time that you knew personally, or was this research that you came across in terms of your work as a psychologist?
Well, Joe, it came to me two ways. In my last book, I discovered that people and women who groomed their in-person social networks across their lifespans were more likely to hang on to their memories longer. They were less likely to suffer from dementia as they aged. And I also discovered that, of course, women live longer than men on average pretty much all over the developed world. And this left me with a question of, why is this? And when I was making the transition to thinking about a new book, I was sitting in a dark lecture hall in Toronto, and I heard an interesting fact, which is that there was one place in the world where men live as long as women. I thought, where is that? Mm-hmm. And I sat up in my seat. It is in Sardinia, a remote area of Sardinia. And right away I thought, I have to go there and find out what's going on. So that was the genesis of the book and the reason for the title, The Village Effect, because people live in those villages longer than they do elsewhere in Sardinia, in mainland Italy, in Europe, and in North America. And it's also a place where men live as long as women, and I felt that there was a social aspect to that puzzle.
Other than being a beautiful place, what did you see there in terms of what they were doing?
Well, one of the interesting parts of doing research there was that, first of all, you're completely embraced by the research people. They pick you up at the airport, they take you everywhere. This is not the same here. There's a question of embracing you when you arrive. But the other issue was that when I went to the villages to interview the centenarians and I would arrive at their houses, time and again, I was struck by the fact that these older folks were never left alone. First of all, they were never in institutions. They always lived in their own homes, usually with family members, sometimes their children, but sometimes nieces or nephews. And there were always other people hanging around chatting with them. So from a researcher's perspective, you arrive there with your tape recorder, and you virtually cannot get them to finish a sentence uninterrupted because there's so many people around them, caring about them, looking after them, chatting with them, and so on. So what I took away from that was that you don't age alone in a place like this. And also that as you get older, there's a reason to live because people care about you. Whereas in many societies, I think including our own in Canada, as you age, you tend to lose your close contacts. People move away. Your spouse or partner may die. You lose friends. And your social contacts get fewer and fewer. Whereas this is not at all the case in a village like that.
So it's one thing to live to be 90, to live to 100. Because people are living to 90 and 100 here in our country, the quality of the life that they lead in Sardinia, I mean, physically, mentally, are they with it?
You know, some are. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously the people I interviewed were, there would be no point in talking to them. But yes, more of them keep active longer in their lives than we do. Many of them keep walking and even hunting, and I describe this in the book, until their late 90s and even their hundreds. So yes, the quality of life is exactly my point, because really I wouldn't want to live to 100 or longer if I was isolated and solitary and nobody cared about me. But I do want to stop for a minute and say that it's not that I'm romanticizing village life per se, but I'm using it as a metaphor for the kind of social contact we all need to survive and thrive.
Yeah.
So it's not like I'm saying let's all throw away our smartphones and laptops and move back to traditional villages. I'm not saying that at all.
Yeah, they can be part of the using our phones and keeping ourselves plugged in. It can be part of establishing, say, meaningful connections, right?
Yes, I think one of the main points that I make in the book, and I make it through human stories and through experiences that we can all relate to, is that, you know, the digital technologies that are so ubiquitous now, they're great for sharing information, but they're not great for establishing human connection or for building empathy and human, really true human bonds. So that's why we should use the digital world to enhance but not replace our real-life connections. So we really need to connect with people face-to-face. You know, even just a simple thing like, you know, a little pat or a fist bump or a high five. We need all of these things to be healthy and happy and to learn well.
Yeah, like a handshake, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, we've lost some of that, I think, in recent years.
Here's an interesting paradox, mm-hmm. which is as our online networks have expanded, our close bonds and our intermediate bonds, meaning the people that we would run into day to day who are part of our world, what I call the village, have declined. So what research tells us is since the mid-80s, since our cyber activity has ramped up, we used to have in the mid-80s something like a little over 3 people we could depend on and confide in. Now we have less than 2, and that would include our spouses, our children, our parents, and our best friends. So some of us have only 1, which is really kind of dire. And on top of that, we have many fewer of the kind of intermediate or middle contacts. And what I mean by that are not your closest friend but the neighbor that you might chat with over the fence or, you know, as you're mowing your lawn, or the shopkeeper that you see twice or 3 times a week, the librarian who you talk to about books, maybe the colleagues that you would bump into. Many of us work remotely now. For students, it's the relationship with teachers and fellow classmates. A lot of education is now happening online, and people just assume it's the same. Well, in the book, I spend a lot of time showing the data that it's not at all the same.
So
not all social contact is created equal.
Yeah, so what has happened? I mean, it's easy to blame technology and the Internet, but I think there's something else that's happening, preventing us from practicing greater human contact in our lives. What is that?
I think you're right about that, because it's easy to blame just one feature of our lives, which might be technology, but that wouldn't be correct. I think it's a combination of factors that's making us more solitary and, in fact, much lonelier than we used to be. We're much more mobile as a society, so we tend to move around, especially to where the jobs are, and this didn't used to be the case. Many more of us are living by ourselves, so we don't have that just casual contact with people that we used to have. So, you know, there's a 300% increase in solo living since the 1920s and 30s. Part of this is a good thing because more of us can afford to live alone if we want to. But part of it is a bad thing because we don't have that kind of contact that just comes day to day by going out and seeing people, meeting people, having dinner with people. And this is extremely important, we're discovering right now, for our health and our happiness and our ability to keep our memories as we age as well. So those are all kind of pieces of the picture. And I will say that one of the most, I would say, surprising questions I've been getting as I've been talking about the book is people have been asking me, well, how do you talk to your neighbors? Mm-hmm. Or how do you build a village? And the first few times I was asked that question, I was frankly shocked, because it seemed to me that people had lost the ability to just strike up a conversation.
Yeah, yeah. So, especially parents who have, say, teens that are they're buried in their phones, scheduling time with them, say, having meal time with them, even with friends and relatives and the sort. I mean, that's important. That's perhaps a first step, right?
I think it's extremely important, Joe, and I think that it used to be that we had traditions that just did this for us, so mm-hmm. we didn't have to think about it that much. In other words, there were regular meals, you had to show up, and at these regular meals, you had to talk to each other. And because our lives have become busier, and because we've had the world pulled over our eyes, and we think that communicating via a screen or text is the same as communicating face-to-face, and it's not. So a lot of our, I guess, habits have just fallen by the wayside. So it's not only family meals, some of it is holidays. Say, for example, religious holidays. Well, you don't need to be religious to celebrate Christmas and Thanksgiving, as most of us know. But some of us, that has started to disappear because other priorities have taken over, when in fact, for children especially, these traditions are extremely important. And they allow children to form face-to-face connections, not only with their parents, but with they're what I call the village, the people who are associated with them and their family. So aunts and uncles and cousins and neighbors and people who are part of, I guess, their community.
Do you worry of the current generation, young people especially, that are too married to technology, that they become, say, less empathetic?
I wouldn't pin this on the younger generation, because I think we've all fallen prey to that.
Yeah.
So, for example, the people who are designing our classrooms around technology, these aren't young people. These are policymakers and people in power in the educational sphere. So they also seem to think that it's better for children to learn from a screen than from a real, highly trained teacher. And if they think that, they're not in touch with the research. So I would say that I'm not really afraid that kids will become less empathetic. I'm afraid that our institutions, which are not being built by kids but are being built by adults, will be designed around machines instead of around social contact.
Yeah. And so what have you found in terms of how to coexist positively with technology? I mean, we're seeing a lot of older people, senior citizens, on Facebook. I get the feeling that as you say, that they're falling prey to it as well. What can we do, say, with all the technology around us, the internet around us, in terms of cultivating meaningful relationships with people?
Well, I think the first step is to not to see it as equivalent.
Mm.
So just as you don't see, like, McDonald's Chicken McNuggets or, you know, a Big Mac is equivalent to your mother's lasagna, you shouldn't see texting and email and Facebook as equivalent to the real thing. And so it means that you have to prioritize actually getting out and seeing people. You know, it used to be that a generation ago, we didn't think that exercise and healthy eating was all that important. And in one generation, that has completely changed. People now exercise religiously, I could say, because they realize how important it is for their health and their happiness and their lifespan. And I think this has to happen with social contact, too. So, for example, you know, as you probably know, writing a book is a solitary process, and you can spend many hours alone researching and writing. But as I started to learn about how important social contact was and how it was more predictive of a long life than, say, quitting smoking or quitting drinking or even maintaining a healthy weight, I started to incorporate little changes into my own life. So, for example, I stopped exercising by myself and started exercising with a group of people. And this group of people has become so important to me, they became part of the book, and some of their stories are right in there in the book, right at the beginning, in fact. So that's one little way that my own habits have changed. You know, if for example, I saw a neighbor just happen to walk by, I'd make sure to stop and exchange a few words with the neighbor to find out how they're doing. I'd make sure that once a day I got away from my solitary work and actually had real social interaction, even if it meant that it took a little bite away from the time I spent with the screen. Because I realized how important this was and that the research really backs this up. But I would also say that it's a question of making kind of a policy choice or a priority choice. So if you're a parent, for example, it is important to limit how much screen time your kids get, just as how you might limit how much candy they eat. I mean, it's okay in small doses. It's not okay in big doses, especially for small children. For your work life, for example, I think that you have to get out and actually mix with people and exchange ideas. Otherwise, you'll become stale in what you do. And there are lots of examples in the book in which I show how businesses that focus on face-to-face contact have really exploded their profits.
Yeah, one of the companies that you mentioned, and I've always thought this whenever I go into a Costco, is how happy everyone's, not happy, but how they like being there, or they appear like. I mean, it's easy to fake that, but I doubt, because I've been to a number of Costcos in Canada and the States, that's just a put-on thing. But you talk in the book about places like that, about the places like Trader Joe's, for example, in the United States. What are they getting in terms of these businesses themselves, in terms of the ideas that you talk about in the book about a better work environment leading to greater productivity, even greater profits?
Yeah, you know, one of the interesting studies that I mention in the book is about how in call centers, when the workers had coordinated breaks, meaning they went on breaks together with their teammates, they were 20% more productive. Their performance improved by 20% compared to teams that took staggered work breaks. Now, this is a huge study of 39,000 people, and staggered work breaks are really the standard in the industry. Now, it costs no more to the industry to have team members go on break at the same time so they can share tips about how well they work or how they conquered little frustrations or problems in their workday. It costs exactly the same thing to the company. So if companies are aware of some of this research in social neuroscience, they can put it to use and really boost their profits. But for some reason, this is an area of science that is sometimes considered soft. And so those businesses, say, for example, that like Trader Joe's or Google, that really pay attention to the new evidence surfacing from this area, are really, I guess, getting the advantages.
Yeah. And if you talk to the workers, saying that they find working there better, that they're happier working there?
Yeah, their happiness improves. Their satisfaction improves, which is an absolutely essential issue, say, in something like call centers where they have huge turnover. But also, among the weakest teams, their performance improved by 20%, and this was billions of dollars in profits for the banks that had hired these call agents. So simply paying attention to the fact that people need each other during the workday. They need to chat. They need to connect. They need to form bonds. And businesses that do that find that not only are they have better retention of their staff, but their staff try harder and do a better job.
In the book, you mentioned Susan Cain's book, Quiet, which a lot of people read because it talked about introversion and put that out there for the first time for a lot of people in terms of how ubiquitous that is in our lives. Do you think there is a way to overcome introversion? Because, I mean, that seems like a stumbling block in terms of getting to where we ought to be if we want the village effect in our lives.
Yeah, I think that there are many fewer introverts in society than we've been led to believe. Mm. It's about a quarter or 25% of the population, so most of us are not introverts. But you're quite right that for those of us who are, it's difficult to get out there and make connections on our own if we don't have the structure, like a classroom or a workplace, that helps us with that. And I think the way to look at it is the way you look at other biological appetites like eating or drinking or sleep or even sex. It's not that everybody needs the same amount, but we all need some to be healthy and happy. And so you have to determine how much you need and the context. So, for example, introverts may not need as much social contact as extroverts, but they need some of it. And they have to be able to control how much. And when. interestingly, those introverts who don't get any, okay, they are much, they have much more disease, chronic disease. They even catch more colds than introverts who are out there and making friends and having face-to-face social contact. So it's extremely important for them to do it in a way that they feel is, I guess, appropriate to their needs. So smaller portions is one way to look at it.
Yeah.
Ways for them to control how much contact that they have. So a friend of mine who's an introvert, he doesn't really like sit-down dinner parties because he's stuck and trapped there. But he likes, say, potluck dinner parties because he can come, spend a little time, talk to people for a little while, and then after an hour, he can slip out and leave. He's had enough. He's gone.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are ways that you can do it if you see it as controlling how much food is on your plate.
Now, this book of yours, The Village Effect, has been out for several weeks now, and I'm wondering, do you encounter a lot of people when you talk about it who are like me, who a light bulb goes off and say, yeah, this is a no-brainer, yeah, you're right, this is obvious, and we aren't doing it, and I'm wondering what the reaction is. Are they making a concerted effort to reach out, say?
Well, you know, it's interesting because what seems familiar is this old-fashioned virtue of getting together, like, oh yeah, I know that. But what's completely new is that we now have evidence that this regular social contact with people in the flesh creates this whole biological cascade of events that have an impact on us. And so people have said, for example, a book reviewer who I just met a few days ago, it was like, wow, that's me. Yeah, I use the internet to avoid people. That's like completely what I do. I've got to change that. So when I feel that I've started a conversation that way, even if it's just a conversation with yourself, I feel like I've succeeded in what I set out to do. But I really do want to start the larger conversation, which is how do we get what we need in a society that is essentially pushing us more and more towards screen interaction because it's more convenient and cheaper, right? So how do we agitate for what we need when, for example, our kids are being pushed towards, you know, interacting with computers instead of with teachers, live teachers in the classroom, or when, for example, for medical care, if you're in a remote place, they assume that you don't need a real doctor, that you can just communicate through a screen, you know. Or, for example, in universities, now many universities are posting their classes online and making online education a priority as opposed to prioritizing the interaction between the professor, the students, and the other students in the classroom. So I'm hoping to really jumpstart a discussion about what we might lose because just as with the automotive revolution that happened in the 1950s, 40s, and 50s, if we all think this is the best thing since sliced cheese, we may not be able to replace what we've lost until it's too late. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we may be scrambling to replace, say, our inner-city communities or the ozone layer, when if we stop now and kind of reassess, we can say, how can we use this fabulous technology while not giving up some of the types of contact that are so critical to our health and happiness.
And I think you have started that conversation. I've enjoyed talking to you today, and I've enjoyed reading this book. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it, Susan.
Thank you so much.
And I also understand that it hasn't been an all-too-pleasant last couple of weeks, so all the best as you recover.
Yeah, no, I've had my own challenges with face-to-face contact in the context of this accident, but hopefully in a few weeks I'll be much more mobile and be able to get out there more.
SusanPinker.com is a website from where the book is called The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier and Happier. It's from Random House. Its author, Susan Pinker, joined me on the line from Montreal. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plante.